Hey, welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode number 440, and here we are. So that's kind of a neat milestone. Well, 10 episodes. We'll actually be at the 50 cent or half century mark, so that'll be pretty much fun. But 40 is still a really good number. So we want to tell you we're the podcast. We have no overlords. We have no sponsors. We have no people telling us what to say or trying to sell you junk. We just tell it like it is. It's unvarnished, and we do it in three segments. We do, you know, kind of events and politics that are related to the Second Amendment. We also do some critiques in the gun culture. And lastly, we do questions and answers, questions that we garner just through daily life or through the comments on the podcast, and we try to answer those as best we can. As always, we'd like to send a big welcome out to our friends from Free America, to our friends behind the tofu curtain in those states that regulate and infringe upon the Second Amendment. We know that, you know, we have comrades out there, and we hang with you, and, you know, hang on. We'll try to get some of this changed around for you guys, but it's going to be a long uphill struggle to change some of the onerous gun laws that exist at state level. That's for sure. But keep the faith and go out and vote and work politically, and hopefully someday, just like the Iron Curtain is a thing of the past, the tofu curtain will be a thing of the past. So let's go to the first thing, and that is the Trump impeachment. And what does that have to do with guns? Well, nothing, except it did derail the gun control efforts that were obviously underway after a couple of mass shootings. So, you know, nothing's going to happen on that. That's gone. And even the candidates, after Beto O'Rourke made an ass out of himself, even they're kind of, you know, they'll say something once in a while, and we'll get to something that idiot Pocahontas Warren said. But even they're cooling off on it. They know it's a loser issue. And that, you know, the Democratic candidate in 2020 is going to die on the hill of socialism and gun control. Their candidacy will die on the hill of gun control and socialism. That's how it's going to be. I mean, they're almost working to hand the Republicans, I think, not only the presidency and retain control of the Senate, the House could shift. It shifted in 2018. It could shift back. So they definitely should not think that they're just going to maintain control of the House. I think that's up for grabs. None of the polls say that. None of the pundits say that. That's just my gut feeling. But this impeachment is going to explode in their faces. And it's already starting to. When you just look, no one can articulate what the impeachable offense is. This is looking more and more partisan. And I think it is more damaging to Biden, old dirty old Joe Bite Me, and his crummy little drug addict son. It's more dangerous to them than it is to Trump. I mean, that's the fact of the matter is, this is privilege and swamp monsters, influence peddling, all that stuff is what Biden was doing. And the fact of the matter is, in Washington, you try to clean that up, and people like, you know, the establishment goons that are out there, you know, fools like Mitt Romney and of course, all the Democrats, and there's probably a few other Republicans. Those jerks are out there. And they're baring their teeth because they have a lot of interests to protect in the swamp. I mean, their kids, they're doing all this influence peddling and everything else too. And they don't want to see their good gig end. But the fact of the matter is, it needs to end. There needs to be a real house cleaning. Get all this stuff out of the way. So Trump impeachment is a bunch of baloney. Everybody knows it's hogwash, just like the Mueller report and all that. That was all hogwash and was all garbage. Well, the next thing is, poor old Bernie Sanders is done. His daughter-in-law just passed away, and then a few days before that, Bernie had a heart attack. He's finished. I mean, he's got nothing new. He's done. I think you'll see his campaign wind down, and he'll gradually recede from the top three or four candidates, and he'll be polling down with, and then he'll he'll essentially suspend his campaign. The most he can hope for is to win a few delegates and kind of at least be some sort of a power broker during the convention. It's hard to say. Hard to say what's really going to happen, but he's not going to be in this race very much longer. I would even argue he's out of it now. He's done. Pete, when you have a heart attack on the campaign trail, that with a big personal loss, I mean, that's just not going to – he's not going to have the enthusiasm, and his voters aren't going to have the confidence in his health, in his vigor, or his attention that he's going to be a good candidate. They're going to go elsewhere. My guess is they'll go with Elizabeth Warren because Biden is damaged goods. Mayor Pete's a joke. You know, this guy, nobody wants – you know, I'm very blunt. Nobody wants a gay president with a first man. Nobody really wants to see that. I mean, you know, if he wants to be that way, it's fine. But I don't know that a lot of people are going to vote for that, you know, put their vote behind that. Kamala Harris is a dribbling idiot. It's clear that she, even as a senator, she's way out of her league. I mean, she's just not very intelligent. She's just not smart. And, you know, I'm sure she connived her way through school and through law school and as a prosecutor and all the rest of it. But the fact of the matter is she's a piece of paper and she's going nowhere. So effectively, we're rid of Sanders. We're rid of Harris. We're basically going to be rid of Biden. You know, he's not going to – this – His association with the swamp is not going to help him. Plus, I think he does not motivate anybody. You know, he doesn't motivate any block of voters or anything. The old, you know, psychotic, radicalized Democratic base of about 15% of the voters, they'll always go with him. And there'll be a few tag-alongs, but he will suffer. If he's the nominee, they will suffer horribly in the 2020 election. And what does this have to do with Second Amendment? What does this have to do with firearms? Well, let me tell you something. Those idiots were the ones who, you know, they've made it known. Confiscation is what they want. If they get in power, they're coming after your guns. And that's turning a lot of people off. Turning a lot of people off. Because it's out there now. It's not about reasonable gun control. All those BS phrases they use. It's not about any of that. They're setting up confiscation. And they're coming for everything. They're going to come for everything. And that brings us to, you know, idiot Elizabeth Warren, you know, a person who's lied her way through life, claiming to be an American Indian when it got her special affirmative action cutouts and privileges and the rest of it. She's now saying, well, maybe there should be a maximum number of guns a person can buy and can own. You know, now, I'm trying to wonder what crime that solves. None of these mass shooters were gun collectors. None of them had, oh, gee, you know, I have 12 1903 Springfields or 20 M1 Garands or I collect flintlock rifles or percussion pistols. They weren't those people. So why would you even think that that's any kind of a solution to anything other than the unlawful bullshit harassment of law-abiding citizens who are engaged in a lawful legal hobby doing what they believe in? And Elizabeth Warren can do the same thing. She doesn't like guns. That's fine. Go race cars. Go collect cars. Go collect any of the millions of things that are collectible. You know, you have the right to do that, Elizabeth Warren. So don't try to tread on everybody else. You know, she knows this won't solve any problem. This is something she's trying to use to appeal to her base of psychotically radicalized and really dangerous people. I told you about the red flag laws. I mean, you look at, and it was Fredo Cuomo, the little jerk from television, who somebody said something he didn't like, and the guy goes mental. He went absolutely mental. And when people looked at that and said, hey, that's red flag laws, that's what it is, you notice that there hasn't been a peep about that since. You look at some of these videos of triggered liberals, and we've mentioned this before, and you see people who've lost control of their sanity. There's no self-control there. And that's red flag law material right there. They've seen that, and now they realize, hey, this isn't just something that we use against Bubba. This could be used against us. And that's why nobody's saying a peep about it. Nobody is. And a big part of it is because they've looked and realized their behavior is much more susceptible to modulation by red flag laws than almost anybody else. So we go from that to the next big story, which is the Syrian withdrawal. You know, and even I've even got family members who just don't get it. We cannot occupy the world, every trouble spot in the world. We just don't have what it takes to do that. And I don't think that that's a position we necessarily want to be in. Of course, the precipitous withdrawal from Vietnam in 1973, you know, led to the downfall in 1975. The whole thing went up. Same thing with 2011, we pull out of Iraq, and then all of a sudden ISIS is on the spot, and the Iraqi army throws down its weapons and runs away. You know, things like that happen. Essentially, well, the big problem is, and there's no easy exit strategy from any of these things. There's a problem, you go in and you assume, well, hey, there's ISIS and they're in Iraq and in Syria, so we'll go in, we'll wipe out ISIS, then it's over. Except it's not over. Except now you have this, there's a population of people there and they're called the Kurds. And we call them Kurds. I think they call themselves the Pesh. And they're nice people. They live kind of, unfortunately for them, they are a fairly large group of people. And they live spread out over four countries. They live in Iraq, they live in Turkey, they live in Syria, and they live in Iran, okay? So at the end of the First World War, they were supposed to get their own country kind of carved out of that area. Never happened. So they wind up there. And in Iraq, they were treated pretty badly. They actually moved, Saddam moved a bunch of them around to try to, you know, get them to... So they weren't concentrated up in the upper east portion of the country, and kind of get them to assimilate, kind of get them to become, you know, Sunni Arabs, basically. Now, that didn't really work, and now most of them have now migrated back to that area, and it's an autonomous region, blah, blah, blah. So there's a piece of Iraq that the Kurds can de facto control, and it's practically sovereign. It really is practically sovereign. But that doesn't solve the problem of the Kurds in Syria, the Kurds in Iran, and the Kurds in Turkey. And the Kurds in Turkey are a real problem because they have been doing, they're terrorists. They've been terrorists there. Whether you agree with their grievances and their reasons for doing it or not, they've been fighting the government there. They're classified as a terrorist group. And, you know, that's bad. That's a NATO ally that has a terrorist problem on its soil. So we've kind of turned our back and said, you know, yeah, we get it. The Kurds in Turkey are a problem, but the other Kurds are good Kurds. And they're you know, good people. And they've helped us out in the past. And they have. Now, they've also helped themselves. By helping us, they helped themselves. And they've thrown off the yoke of Saddam and everything else. But I don't know that we have an obligation to stay there and completely protect them in perpetuity because they helped us. I mean, I don't know what the exit strategy of that is. And it appears that as soon as we attempt to leave that area, that the Turks are going to go in and try to wipe these guys out. They're gonna invade, and they're not gonna be nice about it. And even though the Turks are a NATO ally, that government they have is basically unfriendly towards the United States, and they don't like the Kurds anyway. And the Kurds were helping us, and you know, it's a mess. But I don't know that we can stay in these places forever. You know, look at Korea. You know, we've had troops there for 70 years. And I don't know that that really helps anything. I don't know that does anything except cost us ungodly amounts of money. I mean, it's expensive. expensive to keep an expeditionary force overseas. Look at the amount of effort we did when we had NATO, and we had, you know, NATO's Central Front, when you had the NATO versus the Warsaw Pact, you know, and you had the Iron Curtain and East Germany, West Germany, Czechoslovakia and all. I mean, it was a massive military endeavor that lasted decades. It lasted decades from the early 1950s to the early 1990s. And, you know, we still have some things there, but I think it's scaled way back from what it used to be. But we can't just garrison the world, every trouble spot in the world. Trump is right. At a certain point, you have to draw a line and bring things out and sadly let things play out. He can exert a lot of pressure on Turkey not to do things, and we're starting to see that. But every trouble spot in the world, you just can't put a force in there and say, hey, you know, that's what it's going to be, you know. And I don't know. I don't know where all this comes. We went in there to wipe out ISIS, not really to set up a de facto Kurdish state or help them gain and consolidate territory in Syria. You know, I mean, the Kurds are using us to their advantage, too. And that's, we have to decide whether that's okay or not. And I think at this point, that's really not okay. All right. And hey, our last thing is got a chance. Our friend of the podcast has a Beretta 81 Cheetah. Not to tip too many details, but he did not pay the extra fee and got a beautiful, beautiful pistol. I mean, those things are sweet. We also had a Beretta 92S and a Beretta 92FS out there. And, I think the Model 81 could probably accuracy-wise keep up with them. The only downside of that I would see is that the 81 is a lighter gun. So it's not quite as stable or solid. But intrinsic accuracy, I think it's well matched to the 92, and it's basically just as accurate. Sweet little gun in 32, absolutely nice. Definitely well worth looking into if you're in the market for that kind of gun. I mean, it's a nice pistol, really is. So those are a really great value that are available right now. For how long, I don't know, but they are available now. Hey, just wanted to bring you up to date. We were talking last podcast about, the problems with optics on fighting rifles. And that's basically the way you can look at it. And I remembered a couple of things. First of all, this is the home of the counter-revolution. So that's our other thing. Besides the tofu curtain, we have the home of the iron sight counter-revolution. But I remember back in the 90s. When I was associated with some guys who were working for a tier one unit, one of the things they told me was that for their sniper rifles, and at this time the sniper rifles were a lot less than what they are now. They were all basically bolt action Remington 700 derivatives that had been customized, but really, nothing more than higher speed Army M24 sniper rifles, that type of thing. The calibers, they were kind of flirting with 300 Magnum, but it was really, 7.62 by 51, what we call 308 Winchester in the civilian world. It was those, and, they were ruggedizing them. And, optics presented quite a challenge for that. In those days, not only were optics a lot more primitive, but they were a lot more frail than what you see now. But there were some good optics back then. But I remember them telling me, one of the tricks they did, or one of the techniques, I should say, they had, was they would sight in the rifle, and they would make sure everything on it was tight. All the screws were tight. Everything was, it was good to go. Sight it in. And so, they could still make windage and elevation adjustments, but to make sure that that they wouldn't have the usual problem that you have with combat optics of they get loose, they get knocked, they get somehow wonky, somehow a screw is loose and falls out, and the thing's wobbly on the mount. To preclude all that, It would actually take a welder, and they would weld the mount to the rifle, the rings to the mounts, and they would then weld the rings kind of together and just put a bead on the scope to the ring. And so the whole thing was basically completely welded. Not anything that I think a civilian user would do. Now, that being said, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's done it, to even just to be cool. But, you know, you do that, and essentially when your scope breaks, you know, has an internal problem or whatever else, you have quite a chore to swap it out. And it makes it hard to obviously upgrade or swap, install maybe a night vision device on it as opposed to having the optical scope, whatever. But, you know, the deal was, obviously, they saw the need that, you know, optics can and will fail. And when you have a specialized piece of equipment, like a, quote, sniper rifle, that has to have an optic on it, you have to do what you can to make sure that thing doesn't move. And, you know, in a combat situation, you know, Loctite works good for us civilian users because, frankly, the risk factor isn't there. I was out on a range the other day, and I picked up my M4, and lo and behold, I touched the EOTech, and I could feel a little bit of give. And you know what? The screw, on the EOTech, there's kind of a big screw that tightens up on the left-hand side. Sure enough, that baby was working its way loose. And it was, you know, I could move it with my hand, and I had to, you know, turn it around to hand tight again and kind of cinch it down. But, you know, things like that happen. Now, when that happens out on a range, hey, it's no big deal. It's probably not even going to change the zero or anything like that. However, when you're in a situation where you're really counting on that piece of equipment, you really cannot have that happen. So that's why some extreme measures back in those days were taken. What they do now, I'm not sure. I think it probably, like everything else, runs the gamut. Some units probably do next to nothing. Others probably have a whole procedure of things they do, especially if they're operating in a specific environment, like SEAL teams are going to operate with a lot of moisture and wetness, and same thing with Special Forces dive teams. Teams that operate in the snow might have different considerations, all kinds of things. So I imagine that there's a broad range of techniques that are out there to make optical sights work, which, you know, brings us back to matches and basically self-defense and a few things. You know, there is going to be a counter-revolution to iron sights just due to simplicity and just due to the fact that an optic that goes wrong, as you can see, you know, go on to any of those match videos, you'll see it. Optics that go wrong have a penalty that you may not want to risk in a more serious situation where the dependability of iron sights, they may not be the optimal sighting system, but their dependability will compensate for that. So, you know, the counter-revolution may happen, but thinking about some of these units and some of the problems that competitors and tactical operators have had with optical sights really makes you kind of think. Really makes you think, is it really worth it? And if it is, what do you have to do? What special precautions do you have to take? Very interesting thing to think about. Okay, and one of the other things I want to get to here is thinking about doing a Halloween podcast for some interesting stuff. If you've got a creepy story that involves firearms or involves the supernatural or involves a sighting of a Bigfoot or any kind of thing like that, feel free to just jot it down. Just put it down into like a paragraph or so. And you can email it to me at kbmakel@aol.com. Again, that's kbmakel@aol.com. And I'll be happy to put it on. I've got some stories that'll be that I've heard and some that have happened to me. So we'll put on and we'll have a Halloween podcast. Now, they can be creepy, they can be funny, you know, all that kind of stuff. We can go ahead and have a very entertaining podcast with that. So definitely feel free to send that to me at the address I mentioned. Again, kbmakel@aol.com. And hey, that's going to bring us to the question and answer segment. And we got some good ones here today, some interesting ones. Okay, first question I have is, are main battle tanks and large-scale combat operations, that's the new army word for, or I should say military word for land combat, are those over? And the second part, the implied part of this question is, are we going to see large battles, even like Desert Storm, or, you know, going farther back into history, things like Kursk, are we going to see large armies with tanks fighting each other? You can think of the Arab-Israeli wars. You can think of a lot of different examples where that has occurred. Is it ever going to happen again? And that's a very interesting question, because the tank is the most feared conventional land weapon of the 20th century. I mean, you know, taking the nuclear stuff out and taking out, okay, aircraft carriers and all this, trying to compare apples to oranges and all that. But if you're talking about land combat, which is usually, you know, you hate to tell the Navy and Air Force guys, but basically land combat is the deal. Gaining and holding terrain is it. And the other arms really, you know, they support that. You know, the Navy gets you there, the Navy fights the enemy navies, the Air Force shoots down the enemy's Air Force and all this. But it's really gaining that ground, which is something the tanks do very, very well. But are we ever really going to see that again? And I will tell you that this is not any kind of military theory that you'll hear anywhere else. But I think large-scale combat operations are fundamentally dead. The only way that they're going to happen is if we have an accidental war that's a World War I type scenario. I just don't think that the major powers in the world, that there's any appetite whatsoever for large-scale combat operations. And the fact that you haven't really seen any is proof of that. There's some other indicators too. First indicator was the expansion of NATO's eastern border. You know, now it includes Baltic states and Poland and, you know, frankly, Ukraine wanted to be part of it. So we've pushed back what had been the Soviet menace, now is the Russian menace. That's been pushed back into Eastern Europe, where they're just, you know, you're not going to see the big tank battles on the central German plain and everything. It's the front, if you will, is now hundreds of miles to the east. And we don't see a tremendous buildup in either NATO or in Russia. As a matter of fact, I think you see scaling down. You see the Netherlands, you know, again, not a great military power, but this is just an indicator. You see the Netherlands doesn't have tanks anymore. They used to have 50 or 60 Leopard 2 tanks, a very capable tank. And 50 or 60 tanks is a credible force. I mean, it's for a country that size and of that wealth and positioned where they are, that was a very credible armor force. But that tells you that they're not afraid of Germany anymore. And they're not afraid of the Russians anymore. They're just not. They know that they're just too far away and the Germans are allies. So, and everybody's in NATO. So if they get attacked, NATO will come and help defend them. And so they don't really need tanks. They sold their tanks to Finland. So we now have armies that don't really think that they need tanks. Now you could say, well, the Finns, they thought they need tanks because they bought the Dutch ones. But they're a little bit different. They're not really covered by any kind of a mutual security agreement. So they're a little bit different. But even then, you look at Russia, and you look at Russia developed the T-14 Armata, which is a really innovative tank design. It basically has a turret that has very little armor on it because there's no people in it. The people are down in the hull where there's a lot of armor, and they have automatic loaders and things up in the turret and all the remote systems that they can do these things with. The problem with it is, and it's significantly lighter than a regular main battle tank. Regular main battle tanks now are pushing 60 to 70 tons And this one is pushing, the T-14 is pushing 40 tons. Because they don't have to have all this heavy turret armor. And therefore, they don't need quite as powerful an engine to make it go fast. And, they, you know, there's a lot of benefits to that. But the fact of the matter is they said, we're gonna buy these things like crazy, and by 2023, we're going to be fully equipped with them. Then they said, well, we're going to cut this down. And when I see they, I mean the Russians. Then they cut it down to, well, we're just going to fit maybe our elite divisions with it. Then they cut it back to, well, we'll take 100 of these things and keep testing and evaluating and try to sell them to other people. Then they just canceled the contract altogether. Why did they do that? And I think it was probably two reasons. Number one, I'm sure there are some very challenging developmental problems with this piece of equipment. You know, everything that's supposed to work may not work the way they want it to, and it's going to be a long time for them to sort it out. And the other thing is cost. And, you know, if this were 1955 or 1965, no country would think twice about it. They would, if they had an advanced tank design that they thought would essentially make every other tank obsolete, they would grab it, they would perfect it in a heartbeat, and they would be fielding it. Wouldn't even think twice about it. Not even twice. But now people really aren't. The United States is not really, with any urgency, developing any kind of a replacement for the M1 tank, which is 35 years old now. I understand the first ones came out with the 105mm gun, and now they're upgraded to the 120, and they've got a lot better sighting systems and computers and all the rest. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you go to the Sierra Army Depot, and there's scads of M1 tanks sitting there that have been put through arsenal reconditioning and are ready to go. We just don't have units to give them to. And I don't think there's any real urgency to get an M1 tank replacement. I mean, it's performed well in combat. There's just no, if this were the Cold War, we would have had its replacement on the drawing board 10 or 15 years ago. But there's just no urgency now. And, you know, you look and you say, are we really going to spend a lot of money trying to upgrade and to get a new tank? What's the use of a new tank? And that's why I think you're seeing countries just, if you have tanks, fine, but nobody's really going crazy trying to produce new and better ones. You know, it just they're upgrading current tanks, so they kind of look more like M1s or Leopard 2s. But the fact that the Russians are kind of sticking with the T-72, T-80, T-90, you know, the same, it's essentially the same tank, just kind of upgraded. The fact that they're doing that, the fact that we're sticking with the M1, the fact that some countries are even divesting themselves of tanks, that just tells me that large-scale combat operations are not really the priority that they used to be. And you can also look at, you know, the Soviet Army, they brought out the BMP, which was a very excellent design and ahead of its time. I've ridden and been in them and used them. They're excellent vehicles. But that came out in 1967. And there's really no replacement on the horizon for that. I mean, it still does what it does. It goes as fast now as it did in 1967. There's no imperative to really upgrade or get a better one. I mean, think about things that were around in 1967. You know, think about pickup trucks and cars from 1967. You know, we don't use really any of those today. I mean, we just don't. Look how automobiles have changed, you know, in that 50 plus years. Yeah, think about it. The BMP is 50 years old, you know. The M113, which we use behind the M2 Bradley to do a lot of different things, that's been out since that's almost 60 years old. The Bradley, again, is at least 30 years old. And, you know, there's no real replacement for those. So, you know, literally, they could be in service another 30 years. They could easily be in service another 30 years. So that tells me there's no imperative for preparing for large-scale combat operations. Where you see movement is in special operations. And you see countries increasing and putting an emphasis on special operations. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Number one is, comparatively speaking, they are inexpensive because you're training guys, and the kind of equipment they use may be individually expensive. Their rifles and their pistols might be expensive compared to the conventional forces rifles and pistols, but compared to buying tanks, they're really pretty cheap. The other thing is they're a lot lower footprint. They're a lot more, I don't want to say stealthy, but it's just a lot lower profile, and they get things done. They get things done out of proportion to their numbers and out of proportion to their equipment. I mean, face it, the fight against ISIS really illustrates that. If we were going to fight ISIS in 1990, we would have sent a U.S. Corps from Europe. We would have sent 5th Corps or 7th Corps, which would have 3 divisions. Each division is, with all its support, is about 20,000 men. So we would have sent 100,000 troops. We would have started out in Basra, and we would have fought our way north all the way into Syria and every place else. And we would have had Navy and Air Force and maybe Marines doing part of the mission also. We would have put together a large task force and would have done that. That's how it would have been done in 1990. How it was done this time was a special operations centric type of headquarters that used a lot of proxies. It used a lot of surgical strike type missions, used a lot of the technology of the Air Force and the Navy. So, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. So I don't know that we're going to have large scale combat operations in the future. So I would say the main battle tank may not be dead, but it could be on life support, that's for sure. Okay, here's another one. I started to tell the story a couple podcasts ago about some guys. I was ditch digging, clearing out irrigation and water ditches when some dudes came rolling down the road and were shooting at the cattle on the ranch I lived on. And basically, they made some gestures toward me. Didn't point a gun at me, but they made some gestures. So I went up and grabbed a 30-30 and waited for them to return. And somebody said, "Hey, how did that ever end? How did that ever come out?" And it was very, very anticlimactic, the way that you hope that things kind of end. Basically called the sheriff's department. They came out, took the report. I had a pretty good description of the guys, and I had their license plates. So the long arm of the law went and snagged them. And those guys never came back. So I never had to. I was in no physical danger because they never returned. But anyway, put in the report and all that. They basically, you know, went and rolled up these guys. And I don't even think they ever charged them. They just put the fear of God into them. Back in those days, you could do that. You know, the sheriffs would say, "You stay away from that place. We see you there. We get another report, and we're going to come break bad on you." And I'm sure that's what the conversation was. Never saw the two yahoos again. Never had another problem. So, and it never went to court. Never went, you know, got, they were not justice involved, justice system involved persons, you know, nothing like that. So just kind of died on the vine like that. The police put the right amount of pressure in the right place. So that's how the story ended. It would have been a greater hero story if I'd fended off the hordes and twirled the Winchester like John Wayne in True Grit, I'm sure. But no, nothing like that. Okay, next question is, and this always goes back, we always seem to be talking about these rifles, but did the U.S. military get rid of the M14 too early? And I assume that means, did we really just decide that our main service rifle would become the smaller bore 5.56 M16? And should we have really said, well, that's going to be it? Or no, this is a specific weapon that we are going to kind of keep for, you know, situations where it's really optimal. Understanding the complexity of having two weapons, two different handheld weapons in the drafty army. Although we did that, you know, a lot of people think, oh, just because we adopted the M14, that poof, it was there magically. You know, it took years to transition into the M14 from the M1. as it took years to transition from the M14 to the M16, and you know, my personal experience, the M16A1 to the M16A2, and then the A2 to the A4. None of this happens overnight. Just because they adopt something doesn't mean it. And I did not see it personally. Obviously, I was too young, but there were units that transitioned from the M1, the M1 Garand, to the M16A1. So that'll tell you there. And I think that was probably very, very much happened probably in the National Guard more than the active army. That's just my guess. But, you know, it did happen. So at any one time, sometimes you do have two or three different small arms in the inventory. And the reason that is transitions. And plus, there are just some weapons that just, they're supposed to be replaced, but they're not. An example was the M3A1 grease gun. That served up until the 1990s for armored recovery vehicle crewmen and a few places. Even what we call Delta Force, Operational Detachment Delta, used them in their beginning because, you know, they were carbine small style weapons, a lot of punch. And they could affix sights on them, you know, they kind of rigged some sights on them and had some stuff done. So even these things were sitting around, and combat shotguns are even worse. They just had those things kind of laying around. And, you know, in the Vietnam War, you could come across Winchester 1897s, Model 12s, a whole litany of things all the way up to stuff that was still being produced in the 1960s. And some of that stuff just was always lying around. So, you know, you can't really use the excuse, well, you don't want two rifles in the inventory. Well, we always had at least two rifles in the inventory for a lot of that. So it begs back of, you know, is there a place for a heavy rifle, and then sometimes maybe as the geographic area dictates, a lighter rifle, or if the mission dictates a lighter rifle. I think that would have been a little complicated. I think the main reason it made sense to get rid of the M14 was it was based on Garand technology. And although they didn't know it in 1957, Garand technology was not the way forward. You were never going to develop a family of weapons on Garand technology. It was great technology, had its day in the sun, but it was overtaken by some other designs. And even Italy, which, you know, made the BM-59, they didn't stick with that very long, really. So I would say that the M14 probably, as much as I like it, as great of a rifle that it is, it probably did leave service at probably about the right time. But that does not mean that it is not a useful rifle afterwards. I mean, I think especially in Europe, it would have been very valuable to have at least some units still equipped with them. There were, you know, it's a very, very good design and a very, very good weapon. So it would have made sense, especially given the conditions that you came across in Western Europe. You know, it was really suited, the fact that it would have been compatible with the Allies and all that. It could have been a NATO rifle, could have been a NATO-specific rifle, and everywhere else use the M16. But, you know, it is what it is. The thing that really doomed the M14 outside of the arsenal system, the first thing that doomed the M14 was it took too long to develop. And by the time they developed it, the Garand technology was just not the way forward. So if it had come out in 1947 instead of 1957, it would have lasted a lot. It probably would have lasted longer in U.S. service. And, you know, I was reading an article the other day about, they talk about the Berlin crisis in 1961 and how angry some of the civilian leadership was to see our troops on their way to Berlin to reinforce it, and they still had M1 rifles. And here the M14 hadn't quite made it into the field and into their hands. And so there was a rush to get them to get the M14s into their hands before the operation started. So it was a great, great rifle, but definitely, you know, one of those things. The Krag rifle suffered from the same thing. Good design, and gave good service in the Spanish-American War and afterwards. You know, nobody really disputes that. You could say the Mauser was better, but, you know, I kind of dispute that. I kind of think that the Mauser was technically better. The Mauser was a more advanced design, but really the combat type of situations they were in, it didn't, the Krag was not that big of a hindrance. And same thing with the M14. It gave good service in Vietnam, but, you know, it was the wrong weapon. It was the weapon for 1945, not the weapon for 1965. So it probably got pulled when it needed to, but it definitely, it's still, there's guys still using it out there somewhere today. You know, it's being used by U.S. troops somewhere today, probably in Afghanistan or somewhere else. Okay, here's our last question, and it's kind of very thought-provoking. Very thought-provoking, very interesting question. If you were going into the worst situation of your life, what guns would you want to have with you? If you're going into the worst situation of your life, what guns would you like to have with you? And we can kind of neck this down a little bit and saying, you're going into something that absolutely has the potential to be one of the most terrible things you've ever done. You know, terrible situations you've ever been in. And you can take a rifle, a pistol, and a shotgun. What would you take? And very interesting to think about. Very interesting to think about. My head immediately goes to, well, I would be probably alone and isolated. So I would want clearly a Glock style pistol, you know, a polymer frame, dependable, high capacity pistol. I would want a semi-automatic, you know, like, you know, Benelli M4, you know, shotgun. And I would want some sort of an AR with, you know, maybe 300 to 400 rounds of ammunition on myself and in my kit. So that's immediately what I would say. Thinking about this, what really is the worst situation of your life? And I mean, for many of us, that's already happened. That's called, you know, ground combat. So if you've been in ground combat or you've been in a combat zone, that those decisions were already made for you. And chances are they issued you an M4, an M16, and a sidearm. An M9 or earlier an M1911. But putting this into a civilian context, because obviously you don't get to choose what you take to combat for the most part, I would say that, you know, you have to look at this as a civilian thing, and you also have to look at it as something that you would do where you're going to be kind of isolated. You won't have people around you with support weapons or anything else. These are what you, the most optimal weapons that you think you could use that would essentially save your life, because you're talking about the worst thing that could ever happen to you. That has to be life-threatening. The worst situation of your life has to be life-threatening. So, you know, that's very interesting. And, you know, I do have to say that there's a lot of intriguing answers. And I would say that if I'm in the worst situation of my life, I have some choices I have to make. And I think for a rifle, I have to say, do I want something with detachable box magazines? Because then I have magazines to carry and all that. And I mean that vis-a-vis an M1 rifle. So I'm automatically thinking, maybe I want an M1 rifle where all I carry is ammo in the end block clips, and I know that I'm not going to run out. As long as I got ammo, I've got the clips to feed it in the rifle. I don't have to worry about having, well, 15 or 20 preloaded magazines and then be digging around. I mean, I know that I have that, and I don't have to worry about if the clips, you know, they ping out of the rifle and they go away, but I don't need them again. Magazines I might need again. I might only have six or eight magazines, but I've got more rounds, so therefore I can't drop the magazines somewhere and lose them, because the worst thing that could happen to me in the worst situation I could be in would be have a magazine-fed rifle, and somehow I've managed to lose all the magazines or dent them or somehow, you know, I somehow, there's always a fear of that somehow I won't have the enough magazines. So an M1 rifle would alleviate that. When it comes to a pistol, I really think I don't. At first, I thought I want a very trouble-free pistol, and I thought, well, a Browning High Power is a very trouble-free pistol, and I'm assuming I'm just going to have ball ammunition, so it's not like I got hollow points and things. Really, the pistol I'm not that worried about. I mean, I could go with an M9. I could go with any of the polymer pistols. You know, that anything from a 14 to a 20 round capacity would be fine. I've got some Beretta factory 20 round magazines for an M9. So, you know, anything like that would be fine. The pistol, you know, it is what it is. If you go with 9mm, I do think though that 45 would give me a comfort. So maybe it's a 45 pistol, and maybe my first choice would probably be a 1911 because I'm so familiar with it. But there are other good choices out there, Springfield XDs and things that are in 45. There's also, you know, the new SIG. I think they come in 45. There's other 45s out there besides 1911s. I would probably choose a 1911 because, frankly, the difference between a 1911 that holds 8 rounds plus 1 in the chamber, because I'm not going to be under any kind of military rules, so I can carry it that way if I want. So if I got 9 rounds of 45 in a 1911, it's probably going to be the same weight as 13 or 14 rounds in a Springfield XD or so, or some other thing. So I'm thinking I would just go with a 45 caliber pistol. And I'm also thinking I would go with a pump shotgun, because if I'm in the worst situation I can think of, I don't know that I want to trust a semi-automatic shotgun. Shotguns work really well pump action. They work exceptionally well pump action. They don't have the reliability for me. The extreme kind of situation we're talking about, I guess it'd be fine. You know, a lot of people have good luck with them, and certainly the gamers all use them and everything. But I think I would rather have a pump. I think I'd rather have a pump shotgun. The really hard one is a rifle, because immediately I think, if I really wanted a rifle, and I'm really thinking it would be a 7.62 NATO rifle. I'm really thinking that it would be an FN, a G3, or an M14 clone. So I'm really thinking it would be one of those. Why would it not be 5.56? And the only reason I can think that is if I'm actually out alone and isolated in Canada or Alaska or some place like that, I don't think I could fight off. I could use the shotgun on a bear. You could, a large grizzly bear. But I think I would be more comfortable having, just in that environment, just having the more powerful, rifle. And you know, I think the 45 caliber pistol, because I like 45 caliber. I think it does well. So I would probably go with that. That's an interesting thing. You could easily skew this different ways and say, well, the worst situation in your life really won't be out in the wilderness alone. It'll be in a grid down situation in a city. And maybe then those choices, especially an M1 rifle, might not be the choice that you want, because there could be mobs of people, and in which case you do want the 5.56 with the 30 round magazine vis-a-vis the 7.62 NATO with a 20 round magazine. So you could easily skew this around, but it's interesting to think about, of if your life is really on the line, what weapon do you want to pick up? And everybody, and you put the machismo and all the other stuff aside, just put all that aside and say, what would I really pick up? Especially if it's an unknown situation. You know, you've got to head west and you know that there's going to be no one really to help you, what rifle do you really want? What shotgun do you want? What pistol do you want? And it's interesting. This is something that can be developed. I think it's a very interesting deal because I really didn't consider this question. I accumulated it, but I really didn't think about it until I actually read it here as I'm recording the podcast. And my mind is going in about three different directions as I'm thinking about this. And I guess what that's really telling me is there's no ideal situation. There's no ideal weapon for every situation, which is obvious, just obvious. But it's very interesting to think about what would I pick up if I don't know the situation. It's completely unknown. You just know there's danger, and it's completely unknown. What would you pick up? And, you know, I just have this feeling right now that I would like to pick up an FN. I don't know why. It's not really my favorite rifle. I really like them. It's not my favorite rifle, but I just feel that an FN might be the answer. So anyway, we'll think about that. Maybe we'll revisit this again. But this is it for another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. Remember, hit the like button, hit the follower button, hit whatever button you can hit on the Podbean or iTunes or however you're listening to this. Don't forget, you can send me your scary story or even the premise of a scary story at kbmakel@AOL.com, kbmakel@AOL.com. You can send it there, and I will collect them, and I will read them, and we will do a Halloween show if I get enough responses. Feel free to send me more than one too. If you're one of those people who's had a lot of bad and strange things happen to you, hey, so much the better. We can definitely read the stories here. Anyway, this is Old School Guns. Out.